You guys remember the last day I was talking about, I'll give just a brief summary of the last thing. We talked about the scenario where you have a quantum bounce, and then you can think of how much information can you encode in the field in a pre-bounce era, and it will make it, how much of that information will make it to a post-bounce era. And basically, let me just summarize because I want to talk about something else today. The main result is that indeed you get again an echo of events that happened before the bounce survive after the bounce, no matter how far away from the source of that you are in terms of spatial distance. So information can survive that kind of cataclysm, and in particular, for example, it's been several of the results along those lines that we have show that small little effects that are coming from corrections, coming from quantum gravity. Remember, like when I'm talking quantum gravity here, I'm talking about effective models that you get out of a particular model for quantum gravity, which is Lund quantum cosmology. Lund quantum cosmology predicts corrections that you can call post-Einsteinian corrections. In the same way that you get Newtonian physics and you get post-Newtonian corrections coming from GR, in the same way when you get in the regimes of quantum bounds that are predicted in some models of Lund quantum cosmology, you get post-Einsteinian corrections. So at some point, you get that the energy density is too large for GR to work, but then you get small corrections over GR, so you get corrections to Friedman equations. Friedman equations are no longer the Friedman equations that GR predicts, but they have corrections that come from quantum terms, corrections that come from quantum gravity, and they give an effective geometry that, again, is corrected the same way that you get an effective potential out of the Newtonian potential when you add the first post-Newtonian correction. In the same fashion, you get corrections coming from quantum gravity. And information about those small corrections that are only small corrections are only there in a non-negligible amount of time for times that are very close to the origin of the universe, if you want, to the very early universe times, still make the information about them. If you ask the question quantum informationally, is that information washed out? Does it survive? The information survives. There is another question about how much of that information, even if it survives, is recoverable. So how much of that information can actually be extracted when we look at quantum fields, and it looks like not much of the quantum information can be extracted. However, classical information seems to be pretty resilient. So in principle, and again this is a matter of principle, there is information from early universe physics that is accessible nowadays. Again, I'm talking as a matter of principle. This is not telling you how to look at it, and in particular it's telling you to look at it not with telescopes. Remember, we're not talking about light signals here. We're talking about time-like signals. So you need antennas that are like telescopes, but like basically that like your eyes, but you need to prepare those antennas in quantum superpositions. Okay, it's important that the antennas are prepared in a non-classical state, not in eigenstates of the free Hamiltonian. So therefore, the machines that we use right now to look astrophysical phenomena are not going to see those signals per se. You need to design quantum antennas, and that is a completely different story. Okay, I'm not telling you how to build them because I have no idea how to build them. But what the results actually show is that the information is there. There's time-like signals that reach nowadays. Okay. Oh yeah, and that's people actually like put it like it's kind of nice because they're much better than me picking headlines. So it's a kind of how to pick up messages after they're gone. Even though I'm not telling you how to pick them. What the results tells you is that there are messages that remain there after signals are gone. And there are messages that there's information in there that remains from early universe, and it's in principle still there and recoverable nowadays. Again, in principle, as a matter of principle. Okay? All right, so just a brief summary about all that is that events that generate light signals also generate time-like signals. In particular, if you generated light signals in times of really, really strong curvature, for example, near the early universe, in times associated with early universe, then those signals will have a time-like echo. And that time-like echo, in principle, is observable nowadays. Okay, in principle, meaning that the amount of information that reaches us nowadays is not negligible, still there. It's a different story, though, how to recover it. Okay, that's completely different. This is just a matter of principles result. Okay? All right. Any questions about that before we change? All right. So I'm going to tell you about something different now. So the vacuum. So you guys have seen some field theory, right? And in particular, you've seen free field theories because those are easy. And you guys know that the Hamiltonian associated with quantum fields are bounded from below. So you have ground states, okay? And those ground states are what we call the vacuum. From a quantum optics perspective, people would tell you, ah, the vacuum of the electromagnetic field is the absence of excitations, the absence of photons, right? It's as empty as it can be, okay? It's empty on average, all right? But the emptiness of the vacuum is not quite, so if you look at the Hamiltonian, right, the vacuum state of a quantum field is pretty non-local. It's a state that is defined everywhere. So one can ask the question, what happens if I probe the vacuum locally? So if I have the vacuum state in this room, say, I have the vacuum state in this room, and I start looking at the particle content of a small region of the vacuum, it's not guaranteed that you're not going to measure anything. And in fact, the vacuum, if you look, if you probe the vacuum at short scales, you're going to see particles. Oh, you're going to see excitations of the field, all right? That's what people actually call vacuum fluctuations in many ways, right? And in particular, we're going to take a look at the role that those vacuum fluctuations play in the physics of particle detectors. So here's the thing. Imagine that you have, those are, you may have heard about entanglement harvesting before or not. I don't know if Richard has ever talked about it with you. But how many of you have heard about that? Okay, good. If you haven't, that's fantastic. So imagine that I have two atoms, right? Those spheres here represent two atoms, and they live in different points of space, one here, okay? And the size of the atom basically here is telling you how long they interact, okay? I have the atoms in Faraday cages that I open and close, okay? So they interact with the field for a finite amount of time, all right? Now, scenario number one. I have two atoms that start in a separable state, non-correlated, okay? And then they interact with the field for a finite amount of time while they remain like separated. And then I tell you, okay, initially the atoms were uncorrelated, and then at this point the atoms get entangled, are entangled through the interaction with the field. Would you believe it? It doesn't seem impossible, no? Because these two atoms are like connected, so one can think typical quantum optics picture is, yeah. These two atoms can exchange quanta in the sense that they communicate, so why not they may end up being correlated, no? Seems reasonable, no? I think it seems reasonable. What about this other scenario? So you have two atoms that start out in a completely uncorrelated state, no correlations, okay? And they interact with the field for a finite amount of time, but only during that time they remain space-like separated. Therefore, the atom number two can never know about atom number eight. There's no measurement locally on atom number eight that will give you any information about the existence of this guy here. Okay, these two guys are space-like separated. The theory is relativistic, it's causal, so the theory predicts that this guy will never know anything about that guy. Would you believe it if I told you that these guys start completely uncorrelated and end up entangled? So that's more difficult to believe at first sight. If people in quantum optics will tell you, hold on, how? Because it doesn't seem that these guys can talk at all, so how do they get entangled? Okay? It's really not so difficult to believe. Imagine that I give you a much more simplified problem, okay? So we have a system of harmonic oscillators, and in particular I have systems harmonic oscillator A and B, okay? And I'm given the following task. Get A and B entangled, and the only resource that is given to me to do that is a lattice of harmonic oscillators like that in its ground state. How about it? Okay, so you're given that problem. You're working on stuff like this, and someone wants to generate a machine that entangles A and B, but the only resource that they have is a lattice of harmonic oscillators in the ground state. And you're only allowed to couple A locally to element I in the lattice and to couple B locally to element J in the lattice. Okay? And that's the problem you have to solve. Get them entangled. It's well posed, the problem, right? You understand the problem, all of you? Let's see how we do it. So two possible mechanisms we have. Number one, we couple A to the lattice, we couple B to the lattice. And because of the coupling, A and B exchange, if you want, exchange energy, exchange quanta, right? So they communicate via phonons on the lattice, and through that communication, they get entangled. That's definitely a possible mechanism. Let them talk through the lattice. The lattice is a cable. What I'm doing is connecting them with that cable, all right? So through that communication, of course, you can get the two harmonic oscillators entangled. Of course, this mechanism is limited by the speed of sound because they need to communicate in order to get entangled. That's equivalent to the first picture that we had, right? Here's another possibility. So you guys probably know, because again, this is some of the things that you get bombarded continuously, that an interacting system like that, the ground statements are separable, right? So there are two bases here that are relevant. So imagine that I give you, right, the set of harmonic oscillators and they're coupled, say XX. That's kind of what this represents, right? These harmonic oscillators are coupled. They have you every single harmonic oscillator, you get the free Hamiltonian plus a coupling term that is of the form XX. And then you ask, okay, we have two relevant physical bases here. We have the individual harmonic oscillators bases, right? The Hilbert space, the tensor product just as it comes of the eigenstates of the free Hamiltonians of every harmonic oscillator. That spans the whole Hilbert space, okay? So every individual number basis, if you want. And you also have, well, you have a Hamiltonian, you can diagonalize the Hamiltonian, and then you can identify the normal mode, what we call the normal mode. So the eigenstates of the full Hamiltonian, right? And the one with the smallest amount of energy, the lowest eigenvalue, we call the ground state, all right? Now, the ground state of the whole lattice is definitely not a tensor product of the individual ground states. You know why? Because the Hamiltonian, the free Hamiltonians of a harmonic oscillator, remember the Hamiltonian of a harmonic oscillator contains p square, does not commute with the coupling term, which is xx. So because the Hamiltonians don't commute, they do not diagonalize in the same basis, and therefore the ground state of the full lattice will not be the tensor of the ground states of every individual harmonic oscillator. And in particular, if we trace out the full chain, right, and we look only at element I and element J, these two guys are not in a separable state. They are entangled. And you probably know how this entangled decays with distance and so on, right? It's not one of the things you get bombarded with a little bit. It satisfies an area law. And in one dimension, that would be a logarithmic decay. You guys probably have seen that in many different contexts, all right? But the key point being that two different nodes of this lattice are non-separable. They contain entanglement. So another possible mechanism that you can use for the problem that you've been given is, what if we extract entanglement from the lattice? So again, let's couple A and B locally to I and J. And locally, again, these two guys are space-like separated, so they will measure noise. So in particular, when you couple this guy here, the evolution of this state is going to be similar to the evolution connected to a source of noise. That's what you get. You have the global vacuum, but locally, if you couple locally, you're going to see some vacuum excitations, and that's noisy. And A is also going to see noise. So there is no information about A that this guy obtains here, okay? Because there's space like separated, this is noise, and this is also noise. Doesn't contain information about B. But it so happens that the noise is correlated. So when B is observing noise here and when A is observing noise here, they're not observing individual sources of noise. They are observing correlated noise because of the entanglement that there is between I and J. So in particular, if we couple A and B, and even though the outcome. So A couples, and then some probability of excitation if you want. B couples, some probability of excitation, even though locally they look random. They look that the outcome here is definitely is looking like contains no information about this guy. Okay, even though they look random locally, if you look at the full state of the two, the full state becomes non-separable. What's happening here is that A and B tapped into the lattice of harmonic oscillators and were able to swap entanglement contained in that chain of harmonic oscillators. Because this is a swap of entanglement that already existed, you know, in the resources that you've been given, there was entanglement already in that lattice in the ground state. This guy is not limited by the speed of sound. You're just swapping it. You're not, you don't need to exchange information to do that. All right? So far, so good? If you have questions, please interrupt me. Yep.
Yeah, I don't fully understand the notation you use there all the time. Like, if A and B are not entangled, then you can just split them as a tensor, split their density matrix as a tensor product.
Right.
And here you want to state that that's not possible. So why the sum?
That means that it's not a separable state.
But isn't being separable just the statement that you can write the density matrix as a tensor product of two densities?
No, that's a product state. So it coincides for pure states. So separability is being able to write it like this, as a convex combination of product states. Okay? Product states are completely uncorrelated. So if you can write the state as a tensor product of the two, that means that there are no correlations whatsoever. You may have classical correlations. So you can even have discord. So not entanglement, but another kind of quantum correlations. Then you, maybe if you don't have entanglement, you're still able to write it as this sum. So a state that contains classical correlations would be of this form with more than one summand here. So this is separable. I suppose it's important to distinguish product versus separable. Product, no correlations at all. Separable, no quantum entanglement. All right? All right, so the message, very good. So ask questions, please, if you, I don't want to lose anyone on the notation or anything like that. So, right, so the key point here is that A and B can become entangled without communicating, just because you started with a lattice that was already entangled. And what you're doing is tapping into the correlations that were already in the lattice. Okay? Now, all right, you can think of the simple one-dimensional problem that I gave you as the continuum limit. So if you want a scalar field, for example, scalar field is just the continuum limit of this lattice of harmonic oscillators that I gave you. Continuum limit with some care, but continuum limit nevertheless. So very similarly, as it happened with the lattice case, in the case of a quantum field, you have the ground state, and the ground state is not a separable state in terms of observables that live on space-like separated regions. I mean, maybe you know about that. The vacuum contains entanglement, okay? Again, another trendy thing that you may have been exposed. People usually compute in conformal field theories above all. I don't know how much of this you've been exposed to, but people compute entanglement entropies of different regions of space-time and then find out area loss. Even though the entanglement entropy is divergent, they find that that non-divergent terms follow area loss and stuff like that. You may be familiar with the concept that the vacuum state of a quantum field contains correlations, in particular entanglement, between space-like separated regions. And what entanglement harvesting does is tapping into those correlations and extract them into particle detectors, into atoms. Okay? All right. So, this problem, there are a lot of literature about it. So, first time it was actually analyzed, I described that these things can happen, like you can extract entanglement into atoms. It's this paper by Anthony Valentini, who was a postdoc here. During that time, I believe, maybe? No? You already left? I don't know.
In 1991?
Yeah, it was before.
Institute.
Was that?
Was he Waterloo or yeah? I don't think.
Yeah. He was here sometime, but I don't know, maybe that time.
Yeah,
I don't think. Well, at some point, Anthony Valentini was a postdoc here. interesting enough, that paper went unnoticed completely by almost anyone, so much that Benny Resnick, in 2003, published the result independently. Didn't know about Valentini's result. No one knew, actually. And then for a long, long time, I'm not going to talk about other people, I believe that was the first time that this was described. It wasn't, but no one knew. It's kind of sad. Right, so you have a quick review here of papers, interesting results that, of course, with a bias on stuff that I'm interested in, as you can tell. But in particular, this entanglement harvesting is particularly interesting. I'm going to focus on uses, like, because I want to give you like a more practical, because the previous result was more fundamental. But there are some very important fundamental results out of this. Of course, you don't need to do it with scalar fields. You can do it with the electromagnetic fields and proper. This is done with hydrogen-like atoms. So proper atomic physics, you can harvest entanglement from the vacuum of the electromagnetic field, of course. Interesting enough, entanglement harvesting is very sensitive. Nick Bericucci also used to be a postdoc here, by the way. It's extremely sensitive to the background in which you do it. So entanglement harvesting is more sensitive than any local operations that you can do with one detector to the geometry of spacetime. But not only that, it's also sensitive to the topology. You can have the same geometry of spacetime, flat, and then you can change the topology of spacetime. Say that you do a periodic identification in the topology, or you do like a Möbius strip kind of identification. All those things are sensed by entanglement harvesting. Entanglement harvesting is extremely sensitive to the background. All right, so there have been experimental proposals, of course, and people are working in experimental proposals in different places. In implementing them, I mean. But what we're going to focus in this part of the talk, it's in a practical use of this entanglement harvesting that is called entanglement farming. OK, so question that we can ask. OK, so you can harvest entanglement from a quantum field. Can we do it like continuously? Can we do cycles? Can we like get a cavity in the vacuum and then extract entanglement? To how long? Eventually, we won't be able to do it. Entropy is going to increase there. So what are the limits of these kinds of process? Those are the questions that we can want to address. So in particular, is can we do this sustainably? Can we just keep extracting entanglement from the vacuum? And the answer is, well, not quite, no. If you just used entanglement harvesting only, then you're going to have an entropy increase in your field, and eventually that's going to defeat the purpose. So the amount of entanglement that you'll be able to extract will go down in time as you repeat the process. However, if you combine entanglement farming with a little bit of communication, then you can come up with a protocol in which you can continuously harvest entanglement from a quantum field. And that's what we're going to talk about. We did call it entanglement farming because it makes sense, right? Harvesting and farming. All right. So a little bit about quantum optics that you guys may have been exposed already. I don't know what you guys have seen, like regarding quantum optics, because there were some, not much. OK. I was thinking that maybe some because of other speakers that came before me, but maybe not. So even better, I think, because I'm going to tell you about something. So. In quantum optics, quantum optics, many times I say, one of the things I do is relativistic quantum optics. And then people say, well, you mean relativistic quantum optics? Quantum optics is already relativistic. No, it's light. Yeah. But people in quantum optics frequently, extremely frequently, they do some approximations to simplify the system and make it more accessible. And those approximations are not very nice with the causality of the model. In particular, you came from quantum electrodynamics that was a fully Lorentz covariant theory, but then you made approximations that actually destroy that Lorentz covariance, okay? So yeah, if you want to exploit something that is purely a relativistic effect, you better take care of those things, right? And then I just visit those approximations a little bit. We're going to do it. So the approximations that people usually do are these two. Rotating wave approximation, have you ever heard of that? No? Well, some of you might. Single mode approximation, many times. So they consider like the one mode of the field, and they couple things to one mode of the field. And in particular, they made an approximation on the kind of Hamiltonians that they use, OK? Very often. And of course, very often, like the reason they do that is not because they just want to do to work less. It's because it's very, really difficult to solve the whole problem, right, with the interaction with the field. When these two things cannot be done, one other thing that you can do is a perturbative approximation, a perturbative expansion. And that works pretty well in most cases. For us, for this work in particular, none of them is going to work. So you cannot be perturbative. You need to be non-perturbative. You cannot do rotating wave for single mode approximation. So let's understand a little bit those approximations. So here's a very simplified model, and in fact, it's not normalized properly. It's missing some square root in the amount of volume. But anyway, for the sake of it, it's good enough. So what is this rotating wave approximation that people do? So this is here a typical interaction Hamiltonian between light in a cavity, except for the normalization again of the modes. This is not right. And some internal degree of freedom of an atom. In particular, a two-level system. This is, if you recognize, this is sigma x of a qubit, only that it's written in the interaction picture here. Okay, I should have maybe written it in the Schrödinger picture, but anyway, in the interaction picture. So there's an energy gap of omega between the two levels of the qubit, and I already acted with the exponential of the free Hamiltonian. You guys are familiar with perturbative expansions, I assume. So there are two kinds of terms when you do this product, this times that. Term number one, Lorentz wave terms. So those are the ones that have mixed sigma plus with an A and sigma minus with an A dagger. And counter Lorentz wave terms, they have sigma plus A dagger, sigma minus A. Okay? All right. Here it is in the Schrödinger picture, except for, again, the normalization all the time. It's a square root of omega L. That is in the denominator, should be. Anyway, so these are the Hamiltonians in the Schrödinger picture, and it's relevant. So what do people do? People neglect. So the Schrödinger wave approximation is neglecting these guys. And there you're going to hear it like properly when you can do it. And you're going to hear sometimes, and you're going to read sometimes, and that's something that you should not believe ever. It's like, oh, yeah, we neglect these terms because, after all, they do not conserve energy, they say. That sometimes. And the argument they give is this. Right, so the Schrödinger wave terms are like this. So you have something like a photon in the field, right? And the ground state of the atom. And then through these terms, you're going to have some transition probability to the ground state of the field and the excited state of the atom. So it's like the typical image of a photon is absorbed and excites the atom. Okay? So maybe I can write here, right? So here you get h bar omega at the beginning, they would say, and you go to h bar big omega. And they say, well, in resonance and so on, these two guys coincide, so it makes sense that it conserves energy. Photon in the field absorbed, the atom gets excited, makes kind of sense. No? The counter-Rayleigh wave terms, along those lines, they would say, yeah, so you start from the ground state of the atom, the vacuum of the field, and you evolve with some probability to an excited state of the field and the excited state of the atom. So the atom got excited by emitting a photon in that kind of picture, right? So people do this thing and say, yeah, originally I have nothing, and then I go to this. And people say, yeah, those terms do not conserve energy, they say. But come on. Look at the Hamiltonians in the Schrödinger picture. Do you guys see any time dependence? No, right? So Hamiltonians that do not depend on time, do they conserve something? They conserve energy through evolution. So indeed, energy is conserved. So these guys conserve energy. So the fact that these processes can exist with some probability doesn't mean that energy is not conserved. So what's the trick? Well, the trick is, to begin with, that these guys are not eigenstates of the full Hamiltonian, free plus interaction. So it's not OK to think about the energy of these guys, because that thing is not well defined. You can talk about the expectation value of the energy, and they're going to have some uncertainty. All right? So this is super misleading. So indeed, the counter-Rayleigh wave terms conserve energy. Indeed, they're not time dependent. All right. And the problem is that when you talk about energy, you cannot assign energy to things that are not eigenstates of the Hamiltonian, as these guys are not. Okay? So no, they do conserve energy. No, there's no reason to say that they don't. When you do a calculation of transition probabilities, imagine take this to the interaction picture, for example, and do typical Dyson expansion and leading order, for example, you get that these terms are weighted with this kind of exponential terms, and these terms are weighted with this kind of exponential terms. And then what people do is for example, a single mode approximation. So look at the rotating wave terms, the one that go with the minus. They say, right, for times that are long enough, this integral, okay, grows like delta t only if omega naught is equal to omega j. So there's one mode in particular of the field for which this integral will grow with time. But for all the rest of the modes, okay, so you see for the what we call the resonant mode. So for the resonant mode, that should be an omega, capital omega, no, econ omega naught. Anyway, for the resonant mode, for the mode in which the energy of the atom coincides with the energy of that mode of the field, this integral, it's going to grow linearly with the amount of time. Whereas when you compute it for the rest of the modes that do not coincide, whose energy does not coincide with the gap of the atom, you get something that is bounded. It's actually oscillatory and is bounded by 1 over the difference. Okay? So it doesn't grow. All right? And because of that, they say, well, if the time is long enough, for times that are long enough, in particular like that, times that are much larger than 1 over the frequency of the atom, then you can just throw out all the modes except for 1. That's the single mode approximation. And the rotating wave approximation, along the same lines, is saying, right, in here, there's nothing like resonance or anything like that. There's a sum instead of a difference. So all of them are going to be bounded by 1 over the sum of the frequencies. So for the same token, like when you can neglect this guy, you can also neglect this guy. And then the rotating wave approximation works. You can drop those terms. All right? Only when times are large enough. But what happens when times are not large enough? In particular, the rotating wave approximation and single mode approximation destroy causality. In the assignment, perhaps, that you are going to get, there's some comments and reference to that. So once you do this approximation, so in particular, that's obviously destroying causality. You have just instantaneously coupling two atoms to the same mode, and they see each other. This one also destroys causality. Okay, the model, even though it started from a causal theory, is no longer causal. You don't have a quantum field theory anymore. You have a toy model. Okay, so when you go to relativistic regimes, those approximations cannot be done. And in particular, if you throw out the rotating wave approximation, your detector is not going to be able to see any vacuum fluctuations. Remember, the rotating wave approximation were terms, among others, that were like that. If you start in the ground state and the vacuum, and you are with that, you're going to get something. But if you act with anything or like this or its complex conjugate, this is going to be annihilated. So under the rotating wave approximations, detectors don't see vacuum fluctuations. Okay? Makes sense. To see a fluctuation, you need to be fast. Okay? So detectors that are on for a long, long time where these approximations actually work won't see any fluctuations. Okay? Anyway. So in particular, for what I want to tell you, rotating wave approximation and single or few mode approximation will not work. Okay? So what do we usually do when these two cannot be made, those approximations? We go to perturbation theory. Perturbation theory is basically telling you, well, there's going to be a small effect, okay, very small effect, perturbing the free dynamics of the system. However, in what I'm going to tell you, perturbation theory doesn't work either, because we're going to accumulate an effect that will become big, actually, eventually. So we need to find non-perturbative methods, and in particular, the non-perturbative methods that I'm going to use for this is called Gaussian quantum mechanics. Have you ever heard about that? Good, some of you may have. All right, so that's the paper that I'm going to follow, but you can forget about it for a moment. So yeah, quantum mechanics is difficult, right? So in mind, you have a set of n-harmonic oscillators. So the density operators associated with that are infinite dimensional. Okay? But in particular, if you have harmonic oscillators and particular states of harmonic oscillators, maybe you don't need to take care of the whole Hilbert space. Maybe there's a region of the Hilbert space that's more interesting than others for what you want to do. And in particular, let's look at Gaussian states. So Gaussian states are states with Wigner function. You guys familiar with the Wigner function? Wigner function is a quasi-probability distribution on phase space. Okay? So let's focus only, and given the Wigner function, fully characterizes the state. Okay? I can give you the density operator, I can give you the Wigner function, same information. All right? So there are states that are Gaussian, And Gaussian states, they are nice because if the Wigner function is Gaussian, we need to store only a finite number of variables per harmonic oscillator that we have. So a Gaussian is fully characterized by the mean, right, and the first, and the second moments, right? So you have the mean and the standard deviations. And you compute in all the dimensions that you have the mean and the standard deviations, so that fully characterizes a Gaussian. Okay? What states are Gaussian? Well, yeah, thermal states are Gaussian, coherent states are Gaussian, squeeze states are Gaussian. You guys familiar with squeeze states? Maybe not, I don't know. Squeeze thermal states are Gaussian. People many times call and say, again, this is connect with what is classical and what is quantum. Is a thermal state classical or quantum? Is a coherent state classical or quantum? The question is not really well defined. Yeah?
A thermal state with what Hamiltonian?
With a free Hamiltonian of a harmonic oscillator, with a set of harmonic oscillators, indeed. Yeah. Thermal states of free harmonic oscillators, okay? So when you have a thermal state, say a free harmonic oscillator, and you have a thermal state, is that classical or quantum? Would you call it classical or quantum, that state? How many people think that's classical?
What does that mean?
Ah, that's the right question to answer. Many people would say coherent states are kind of in the boundary of classical and quantum. Thermal states are pretty classical. Yeah, what does that mean to be classical? Maybe that's a question I can ask you. What would you call classical?
Well, I wouldn't call any of it classical.
So, depending on what you ask, in particular, I would call, without any other directions, I would call a state quantum. If you're looking at the observables that you're looking, the expectation values are much larger than the uncertainties, for example. So then I can't describe them very well with classical statistics. Now, for example, the vacuum state of a field, very few people would call it classical, but it's a particular case of a thermal state and a coherent state. Thermal state with zero temperature, or a free field, it's the vacuum. Coherent state with zero alpha, it's also the vacuum. So the question of something being classical or quantum needs more context. So what do you mean by quantum or classical? All right. Some people would say, if the Wigner function is non-negative, that is classical. That's a thing that people use as a measure of classicality. Is the Wigner function negative or not? The negativity of the Wigner function is considered a measure of non-classicality. However, the vacuum state has a positive Wigner function, and I would not call it classical. What's that?
But it has entanglement.
Oh, yeah, and squeeze states and multimode squeeze states have entanglement and still have Gaussian Wigner function. So states with entanglement are called, in many instances in quantum optics, classical, according to the criteria of the Wigner function is positive. The reason you call it classical, we can debate about it, but it's like, yeah, you can come up with a stochastic classical theory that predicts all the observations here, a very funny stochastic classical theory. Why? Because the Wigner function now is a distribution of probability if it's positive. So you can think of a stochastic theory, perhaps very funny, that explains the observables of the observations of that. Of that theory, okay? Anyway, just so you know and you're warned, when people call states classical or non-classical, yes?
But Bell proved that you can't, no? Like, there's something weird happening.
No, Bell didn't prove. So you can ask Rob Speckens, for example. You can actually have theories that are not quantum mechanics that have the same kind of statistics as non-locality statistics. So what this? So again, I'm kind of criticizing. I'm not defending that these states are classical. In fact, I don't think they are. What I'm saying is that you will find in the literature people saying a measure of classicality or a measure of non-classicality is the negativity of the Wigner function, and I'm challenging that notion. They will tell you states, Fock states, for example, would have negative Wigner function, and they will say, right, I cannot understand this as some classical stochastic theory in phase space. Classical stochastic theory means I have some stochastic theory and I give you probability distributions of phase space, of finding my system in a particular configuration in phase space. If the Wigner function is negative, there's no way you can assign a stochastic interpretation because it's not a probability distribution. And they say because of that, right. So states that have positive Wigner functions, then I can think of stochastic classical theories in a way that give me, that I interpret as configurations in phase space with some probability. Now, all that I'm saying is that states with entanglement can have positive Wigner functions. So you're already convinced, that's what I mean. So when you read about measures of non-classicality, if you Google measures of non-classicality, one of the paramount ones you're gonna find is negativity of the Wigner function. Kind of challenging that a bit. Anyway, so Gaussian states. So imagine a Gaussian state center at zero, okay, in phase space. That thing can be characterized by just the second moments like this, the standard deviations in phase space. Okay, well, these guys, these x's here, are the positions and the momenta. Okay? So all this thing about Gaussian states being easy to store, in the sense that you don't need much memory to store them, because you no longer need to, per harmonic oscillator, you don't need an infinite amount of numbers to store them, would make no sense if your evolution takes you out of the set of Gaussian states. Gaussian states are easy to classify and to characterize, but if you have some evolution that will take you out of Gaussianity, of Gaussian states, that will be worth nothing. So we can ask the following question. What kinds of Hamiltonians preserve Gaussianity? What kind of Hamiltonians map through time evolution, time evolution generated by those Hamiltonians, map Gaussian states into Gaussian states? And the answer is quadratic Hamiltonians, Hamiltonians of this form, Hamiltonians that can be written as a quadratic form of, say, Hamiltonians coupling a set of n harmonic oscillators, Hamiltonians that coupled n quadratically preserve Gaussianity. All right? So we can simplify time evolution when you have states that are Gaussian and Hamiltonians that preserve Gaussianity. So we have the typical picture in Hilbert space. You get, you know, a state. This is a vector Heisenberg picture, a vector of position and momenta, depending on time, that fully characterizes your system. And of course, in the usual Hilbert space evolution, you can write that as a unitary transformation. Okay, but in particular, if we're talking about Gaussian states, transformations that map Gaussian states into Gaussian states are symplectic. In particular, I can write this vector of quadratures, of x's and p's, of q's and p's, as some linear transformation. Again, if I have Hamiltonians that do not displace, okay, the only thing that they do is a quadratic transformation with no displacements. So in general, this would be an affine transformation. But I'm focusing on things that remain centered at zero. So the transformation would be symplectic, okay, whereas it's a symplectic matrix. And in particular, we can have the collection. Remember, that sigma is the collection of standard deviations. So you can ask, OK, for a state center at zero, the average is not going to change. What's going to change is the standard deviations. OK? So how do the standard deviations change? Well, they change like this. OK? They transform through symplectic transformations. So you can map from here, you have Heisenberg equation. You can map Heisenberg equation into an equation involving the symplectic form. Okay, the symplectic form plays the role of the evolution operator for Gaussian states in this case. Okay. So, oh, by the way, this is the symplectic form that is preserved under evolution. Anyway, so we can apply this now to the light matter interaction. So you have m atoms. Well, atoms model at harmonic oscillators. So you can wonder if that's a good approximation or not. So let's say you have m harmonic oscillators coupled to a quantum field. And then the next n, very many of them going to infinity harmonic oscillators, we can consider the modes of a quantum field in an optical cavity, because there's a discrete number of them. All right? What do we win here? So we have a non-perturbative approach that can treat time-dependent problems with no approximations. And that's what we use. Now, yeah.
But you just said light matter interaction, but interaction is never Gaussian.
It's never what?
Interaction is never Gaussian. Like
the interaction, the light matter.
Hamiltonians, right?
The light matter interaction is of the form. So imagine that my I couple a harmonic oscillator in the same way that I couple an atom. So an atom couples. So an atom couples like this, if you want. Let's say this is a scalar field, just to simplify things. So this guy is the scalar field. This guy is the internal degree of freedom of your atom. So in particular, for a two-level system, that would be a coupling of the form sigma x times the field. This couple is quadratic. Like matter interaction, dipole coupling, that's a typical coupling of atoms to lights. The coupling is quadratic. This is an x operator, if you want. And this is another x operator. So it's a kind of x-x coupling. So the light matter interaction, it's the Hamiltonians are quadratic. The Hamiltonians are always of the form of some A plus A dagger times some sigma plus sigma minus, if you want. That's a quadratic Hamiltonian. Okay, so in the light matter interaction, the Hamiltonians are quadratic. In the standard model, there are very few coupling terms there that are not quadratic. None of the standard ones are. QED is quadratic, only with fermion fields, though, but quadratic nevertheless. Chad, what Hamiltonian would not be quadratic?
There's a psi bar A psi, right?
Right.
Three terms.
That's still quadratic. It's a fermionic coupling, though.
What do you mean that's quadratic?
So it's quadratic in the AA daggers, in that sense. So it's three terms in there, but it can be written as quadratic.
No, but you have gauge fields as well, right? And if you have QED, you're going to couple like either scalar or fermion.
Fair enough.
Yeah.
So the coupling between, so it's that is actually true. So the coupling between scalar fields, for example, or between two scalar fields in the standard model is always quadratic. The coupling between fermion fields is not quadratic in the and gauge fields is not quadratic in the fields, but it's quadratic in the currents. So it's a quadratic Hamiltonian in bosons. So that's the key point. So you couple bosons to bosons quadratically. So you get two fermion fields, and that's a boson, and two fermion fields couple to a boson field quadratically. Okay? Again, it's a quadratic, it's algebraically a quadratic Hamiltonian.
It's a bit funny, right? Because I mean, when you do QFT, everything you do is like perturbation theory, because you can't even write like the vacuum of interaction field because of that, right? So it's a bit counterintuitive why in here that's fine to use Gaussian theory. You see, like,
oh no, you can't. So it's completely different to say okay. That's completely different. One thing is to say that the Hamiltonians are quadratic, and another is that Gaussian quantum mechanics will fully describe the standard model. That's completely different.
Okay, so it's sort of like constructed by this model to study this sort of like model.
So these models are going to be used only to restricted cases, in particular cases of light matter interaction like this.
Okay.
So there are two debates here. How common are quadratic Hamiltonians, and how good would be this formalism to describe the interaction of quantum fields?
Right.
Those are completely different.
Yeah.
All right? So in particular, you're going to have terms here that would displace, and in particular in the standard model, and you're going to have interaction terms that completely destroy this thing. So all that I'm saying, for if you just look at the sector where you have interactions that are quadratic, this will work.
Sure.
Okay? All right. Any more questions about that? Because that's really important. Because if you doubt the model, there's no point in talking about the consequences and the predictions. In the light matter interaction, in the simplest way, the Hamiltonians are of this form that you may have seen. This is a dipole coupling. So what you do here is, yeah.
So if you claim that QED is quadratic, why can't we just exactly solve it? Quadratic theories are pretty easily solvable, right?
Right. So the Hamiltonian, the coupling Hamiltonian that comes out of that is quadratic in currents, but the Hamiltonian itself, so solving QED, so it's very easy, for example, to solve evolution of the vacuum to Gaussian state. So if you consider only squeezing terms, so not all states that are interesting are quadratic. For example, Fock states are not Gaussian states. So that's exactly what I was saying. The fact that the Hamiltonians are quadratic or can be written as quadratic in some modes. So okay, steps. QED, it's quadratic in currents. It's not quadratic in fields to begin with. So one can say, okay, I move to canonical variables currents, and I move to canonical variables, the variables that are associated with the gauge field. So to begin with, not all states are quadratic. So the vacuum state of such a theory would be Gaussian.
Okay, but here also not all states are quadratic. That's not the point. But if I have a QFT with a quadratic Hamiltonian, quadratic in the fields, then I can just like go to Bathenagel formalism and just like integrate the thing.
Yes.
And like after performing that integration, I can easily calculate everything, and everything is exactly solved.
Right.
But QED is not that simple. So you're using a different notion of a quadratic Hamiltonian.
What I mean by, okay, maybe. The quadratic Hamiltonian that I'm using, the notion of quadratic Hamiltonian is quadratic in the variables in the quadrature. So if you have a coupling that is of the form canonical X, or in general, canonical X, symmetric matrix, canonical L straight. So this guy containing S containing Qs and Ps. That's the kind of Hamiltonians that I'm considering here. So again, QET is not quadratic in the fields. QET would be quadratic in the currents. So there's a transformation that can get QET into something quadratic in the currents, and that transformation allows you to treat some states and some evolution in an easy way, but not all of them. For example, you cannot have Fock states treated with this formalism.
Yes, but you can never get, you never can.
You never can. No,
for instance, if it's quadratic, you can do certain calculations which like exactly solve your theory.
Right.
Whether you can easily get a time evolution for certain states or not is irrelevant.
Not quite.
It's not irrelevant. It's a different question.
It's a different question. So here's the point. So what I'm doing here is computing time evolution in an easy way from certain states to certain states. So in particular, for the kind of Hamiltonian that I'm considering here, which is the Hamiltonian of the light matter interaction, that is of this form. It's a quadratic Hamiltonian, then I can compute time evolution from Gaussian states to Gaussian states. That I can do, because that Hamiltonian is preserved Gaussianity. And what I'm going to do here is go from a vacuum state, from the global ground state of the system, that is a Gaussian state, to something through this quadratic Hamiltonian that will be Gaussian. And that's all that we're going to do. But that doesn't cover the full quantum evolution, indeed. You can only move from Gaussian to Gaussian with this formalism.
Yes.
All right? Okay, so that's the only claim I'm making. All right. So, following setting, you have two harmonic oscillators that are going to play the role of your atoms. What time is it? Okay. Two harmonic oscillators that are going to play the role of your atoms and the ground state of the quantum field. Okay? And it's in a cavity. Again, this formalism only works for a discrete number of modes in particular, otherwise it's not computable. So this is only practical to compute things when you have a discrete number of when your Hilbert space of the field is discrete. Okay, that's why we use an optical cavity here. So you have n harmonic oscillators in the cavity, n going to infinity, and then you have two harmonic oscillators that play the role of the detectors that you have. And you couple them to the cavity and you make them fly. Okay, so easy to compute in the same way that we were computing before when you had, remember, the chain of harmonic oscillators. When the atoms fly through the cavity, they get slightly entangled. So if everything starts in the ground state, the atoms get slightly entangled. If they spend enough time, so they get entangled through two different mechanisms. Mechanism number one, exchange of quanta. Mechanism number two, vacuum entanglement harvesting. Okay? So what happens if you start in a thermal state? Again, the Hamiltonian is the free Hamiltonian for the field, so a thermal state is a Gaussian state that is centered at zero. So if you start in a thermal state, if you fly two atoms in the ground state through the cavity, what you get is that the atoms do not get entangled. And actually very fast, as the temperature, you see that's a separable state. As the temperature increases, the atoms lose their ability to get entangled through the field, even if you allow communication. There's too much local noise. One can prove that for a finite temperature, it's impossible to get these two atom entanglement interacting with the field just flying through. Okay? For a finite temperature, and not too big. The temperature is related to the scale of energy of the detectors, the gap of the detectors. Now, that would be bad news, because it means that this kind of mechanism cannot get the atoms entangled. But what we can do is repeat the process iteratively. And that's what it's going to make it non-perturbative. One can actually repeat the process many times and look at the fixed points of such dynamics. So in particular, if you repeat the process many times, you apply time evolution many times, you're going to find fixed points. They're going to be attractors. So are there any fixed points that are interesting? So let's say. So the dynamics, how do we treat the dynamics of this problem? So we begin with a Gaussian state that is described by this covariance matrix. Okay. And in particular, the covariance, the nice thing about covariance matrices as opposed to density matrices in this picture is that the covariance matrix of the total system is the direct sum of the covariance matrices of the other systems. So that makes it extremely easy to trace out systems in the Gaussian formalism. Tracing out is just removing a sector of the matrix. It becomes extremely easy in that case. So we begin with the field in an arbitrary Gaussian state, still Gaussian state, but arbitrary. And we begin with the two detectors in the ground state. Okay? And we fly them through the cavity. So after a first time flying through the cavity, the evolution, the symplectic evolution generated by this quadratic Hamiltonian that couples the detector to the cavity, again, you're coupling in this way. You have the x, the interaction Hamiltonian is x of detector 1 coupled to the field plus x of detector 2 coupled to the field with some strength. All right? Mimic these kinds of Hamiltonian. All right? So after the first iteration, after going through the cavity, your state evolves to this. And as you can see here, you get the partial states of the detectors and the field that are very easy, are just these blocks in the covariance matrix, and you get cross correlations. What we do next is we throw out the atoms. Okay. We throw out the atoms. That's what happens when I throw out the atoms. And then prepare a fresh pair and repeat the process. And you repeat it many, many times. Okay? And repeating this process iteratively, you can ask, what are the fixed points of such evolution? Okay? So, one can, it's a relatively easy problem. I'm going to skip these details because it's not that important. It's a relatively easy problem to find the fixed point of such evolution. Right. And look at what happens from the fixed point. This is the three different, this is negativity. You're familiar with that. It's a measure of entanglement. In particular, for Gaussian states, it's a faithful measure of entanglement. So you have two harmonic oscillators in Gaussian states. Negativity is going to tell you it's non-zero if and only if the states are entangled. And it's an entanglement monotone. Okay, so it gives you, it's a measure of the amount of entanglement of the two detectors. And this is what you get depending on the number of cycles that you repeat the process. And in particular, see that for the case of the vacuum, if the field starts in the vacuum state, you extract more negativity at the beginning, but then it goes down, right? For the case of, these are different temperatures. Everything here is natural units of frequency normalized. So the units here, what's giving you the energy scale here, is the gap of the detectors. So the energy gap between the detectors, that would be the difference between the levels of the system that you're considering. Your harmonic oscillator, the spacing of the levels. So these two temperatures are huge. In particular, so if you consider something like a hydrogen atom spacing, that kind of spacing, the spacing corresponding to a hydrogen atom, this is temperature that is of the order of 1,000 kelvins in particular, the temperature associated with that level of energy. So if you have a thermostate you got of high temperature, you can see how at the beginning you get no entanglement out of the atoms that come out. But if you repeat the process long enough, you reach a fixed point. And the fixed point allows you to, this is negativity as well, allows you to extract entanglement. So after you've driven this cavity, you throw the atoms through the cavity, and you've driven this cavity to a fixed point, the fixed point is such that the next time you throw two atoms, they're going to come out entangled. Okay, so, sorry. So the question is here, okay, so if we keep throwing atoms, the cavity, the atoms are going to come out entangled. If we keep throwing these harmonic oscillators, the harmonic oscillators are going to come out entangled. And in particular, you can keep repeating the process as much as you want. And look at what happens. The interesting point is that this is extremely stable even under increases of the temperature. So again, the assumption, the main assumption here is that the states were originally Gaussian. Otherwise, this formalism doesn't apply. But if you consider different temperatures, okay, the fixed point is reached more or less at the same scale of iterations. So this process is a sustainable way to drive an optical cavity, in particular to a state that allows for extraction of entanglement. So you basically have a box, and then that box is in some thermal state. Then you start throwing in probes and in pairs, and the pair of probes that you throw are going to drive the cavity through the time evolution of this whole system to a point in which you can actually continue extracting entanglement indefinitely. I had some thermodynamic studies of this, but I think that because of time, that's as much as I can tell. Yeah?
Which is the physical intuition of this?
Say again?
Which is the physical intuition of this number, this critical number of cycles where there is a shift in the negativity of finite temperature?
So you mean this guy?
Yeah.
Physical intuition, meaning what is the scale that gives it or something like that?
Why is this change in the...
So when you do it, so the process, that's part of the thermodynamic analysis that I had anyway. So what you're doing here, when you do these processes, you can actually prove that it's a non-quasi-static process. So you're taking the system out of thermal equilibrium. So what you're doing right here is pumping entropy to higher mode. So here's the thing. So you have a cavity that is in a thermal state. And the atoms are in the cavity for a finite amount of time. In that finite amount of time, they're going to only see, or only see strongly enough, some of the modes in the cavity. In particular, basically, the Fourier transform of the function that tells you how strongly they couple in time. So they enter the cavity, say, traversing the cavity like that. So the cavity wave function modes, the wave function of the cavity modes is a Gaussian. Okay? So think of a Gaussian switching function. So the strength of the interaction would be something like a Gaussian. Okay, goes up and down. Okay, when they exit the cavity. And what they're doing during that time, they're basically seeing as many modes as the Fourier transform of that. Okay? So they see, for example, they see the modes, they interact a lot with modes they're resonant with, if the modes are excited, right? And they're going to also interact with modes surrounding those. And there's, again, there's a Gaussian weight to that. So in those modes, there is some entropy. Okay? So what the atoms are doing when they interact first is they come cold. Remember, those are the ground state atoms. And what they're doing, they're cooling down those modes. Well, basically, you have something in the ground state interacting with something at a given temperature. So there's going to be a flow of entropy through the atoms. Okay? So those atoms, mainly at the beginning, they're going to be removing entropy from the system. However, they're not going to cool, not going to be cooling down the cavity. It's not really a thermal process. You cannot associate a temperature to every step. Why? Because the atom, even though it's seeing mainly modes that are close to the resonant frequency, it's also interacting slightly with modes that are of higher frequency. So in the first iterations, where the regime is all perturbative, you just done it a couple of times, mainly you're just taking entropy from those modes. Okay? As you keep doing the thing, you start accumulating effects. So the non-perturbative nature of the process is precisely what happens at long times. In long times, you have basically removed all the removed as much entropy as you can from the resonant modes, but then you have dumped that entropy, but still you are building up entropy in the higher modes. So as you remove entropy from the resonant modes, you're pumping up entropy to the higher modes, and it's not a conserved thing. So because the atoms are taking entropy out of the system, okay. So what's happening here is that you have cooled down the modes that are close to resonance enough to be able to extract entanglement. And in fact, if you keep doing this, you see that the fixed point is stable, but it's not really stable, it's metastable. Eventually, when you do it a lot, you're going to have the increase of excitations, the increase of entropy in the higher modes are going to destabilize the system. Like, there are three scales in this problem. One, the cooling down scale of the modes that are close to the atom resonance, and the other one is the entropic collapse of the modes that are very, very far away from resonance. So this scale, it's related to the gap of the atom, the energy in the atom, how fast you can thermalize, the atoms can thermalize to the resonant modes. The scale at which this will fall is related to the strength of the interaction, the coupling strength of the interaction. The interesting thing, though, is that this is idealized, right? You have a cavity that is perfect. In real life, you're going to have a cavity that leaks. And the leakage is much higher in the modes that are non-resonant, the higher modes. So one would expect that buildup of entropy will fly the cavity faster than the cooldown of the atoms. So in particular, I would expect that this would be stable under that. But yeah, the scale that gives that is the gap of the atom. Basically, it's a cooling down of the modes that are close to resonance. Kind of makes sense. You're doing two things here. It's like a hammer, right? It's the Kempf hammer, we call it, actually. You have a hammer that is very cold. And you start hitting something that is very hot. What's going to happen? On the one hand, it depends on, there are two scales. How much contact time do I have? And how fast I'm putting energy into the system. So you have two effects. Well, the hammer is in contact with the system you're hammering down. The system is going to cool down. Because there's going to be a flow of heat and a flow of entropy from the system to the hammer. However, you're doing something very sudden. You're going something very fast. So you're heating up the system as well as you hit. Only because of the difference in scales, right? The heating, the entropy that you're building up when you hit is going to some degrees of freedom, whereas the cooling down is happening to different degrees of freedom. So in particular, the cooling down, if it's not long enough, it's going to happen only locally, whereas the heating up is more non-local because you're heating very, very strong. So the Fourier transform of the function that is exchanging the modulating the exchange of energy between the hammer and the and the and the system is very the impact is very tough, is very fast. So you are putting a lot of energy in the localized kind of way, but if you keep the hammer here, you're actually taking entropy in a very localized way. So that's the kind of phenomenon we have in here. Any more questions? Cool. All right. So just for the record, I never claimed that you can solve QET fully with Gaussian quantum mechanics. Never. Just in case, I don't want that to be recorded. Yeah, that's why I was afraid.